Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the panel, good morning. Happy Wednesday. My name is Mark Victor. I'm with the Attorneys for Freedom Law Firm, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Beal. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if possible. Thank you, Judge. Mr. Beal was convicted of participating in a Hawaii conspiracy. The Hawaii conspiracy lasted over 10 years, and it dealt only in cocaine and in methamphetamine. There was no fentanyl ever sold, transported, or discussed in the state of Hawaii conspiracy.
How do we know that?
Well, from the record. There's testimony in the record. I could cite you to it if you like. In fact, the main testimony came from Mr. Oliverdi, who was the only conspirator from the Hawaii conspiracy who testified at the trial. He specifically said there was absolutely no fentanyl involved in the Hawaii conspiracy. I don't think there's any dispute on that point. There's nothing in the record that suggests otherwise. The record's very clear about that point. Mr. Beal had never been to Hawaii. He had no discussions with anybody in Hawaii. He had no discussions with anybody involved in the conspiracy in Hawaii. He had no discussions with anybody charged in the conspiracy in Hawaii.
I assume you agree that what you're calling the Hawaii conspiracy was not just limited to Hawaii, it also included California, right?
That's true. The drugs came from...
So, I mean, you just as easily call it a California conspiracy that it involved Hawaii. So then the question is like, is it a California-Hawaii conspiracy and a California-Ohio conspiracy?
So I think it's an excellent point, Judge. I think it's very fair to say that the Hawaii conspiracy involves two people, Mr. Fanua and Mr. Manoa, who were involved in both conspiracies. So I concede that point. And the drugs came from California to Hawaii, cocaine and methamphetamine only. But what I'm calling the second conspiracy is completely different. Of course, it did have two people who were common to both conspiracies, as we know from the Supreme Court's case. Just because we have people who are common to both conspiracies doesn't automatically merge the two conspiracies. I'm not arguing that otherwise either. The only two people, Fanua and Manoa, who were involved in both conspiracies, that represents the entirety of the connection between the two conspiracies. Absolutely nothing else in common. What we might call the California-Ohio conspiracy was a one-time transportation of drugs, some kind of white powder for sure. My client, Mr. Beal, picked up a bag in Ohio. He had it for about 10 minutes. The vehicle he was riding in was pulled over. He was arrested, the bag was searched, the white powder was found. That's the totality of his involvement in the case. There are 5 issues on appeal, and I don't think I'm going to get to all of them in 15 minutes, but just to lay them out. First, I think maybe the most serious issue in the entire case is the fentanyl, who eventually was tested as fentanyl many years later, should not have been admitted at the trial because there was what I would call a fatal chain of custody issue. That's issue number one. Issue number two, maybe equally as serious, the third superseding indictment. This is the indictment that charged Mr. Beal with the fentanyl conspiracy. There's no question this was filed after the 5-year statute of limitations, and I would say fatally past the 5-year statute of limitations. The third issue is an insufficiency argument. My argument is that there's insufficient evidence of a fentanyl conspiracy connected to Hawaii, which is what Mr. Beal was convicted of. And third, the trial counsel requested a specific unanimity instruction to avoid confusion, to avoid the fact that the jurors may not have been unanimous about which of these two conspiracies they were convicting him on. This was requested, and it was, in my opinion, erroneously denied by the trial judge. And finally, the argument that venue was not appropriate in Hawaii. However,
the last three all depend on there being two conspiracies.
That's close, but I don't totally agree, Judge. And I'll tell you why. I certainly do agree on the venue point. If there's one conspiracy here, venue is appropriate in Hawaii, even though I'm not conceding that point. But as to the unanimity instruction, even if there was one conspiracy here, my argument as to unanimity is the jurors could have been confused. In fact, there was evidence in the case that was brought in counsel for the government in his rebuttal closing argued that this was a methamphetamine conspiracy. Now, maybe that was a mistake. It was also evidence brought into the case that when the white powder was initially seized, it tested as cocaine.
So, all right, well, on that, where was that evidence brought in? It was not a trial, right? There was no evidence at trial of that. Is that correct?
That's not correct. There was evidence at trial that there were two places at evidence in trial where, and I might be able to even cite you in the record to exactly where it was, if you give me a moment to find it here. The jury heard evidence that there was white powder thought to be cocaine, and it came from Agent Nan, who was one of the case agents. And this was argued in the Rule 29 motion on page 8. And I can cite you to the transcript on January 23rd, 2021, page 35, lines 10 through 19. They heard that evidence. In addition, counsel for the government argued that there was a meth conspiracy in his rebuttal closing. This I would cite you to volume one, supplemental excerpts of the record, 176, lines 14 through 19. You can also find it in the record of the transcript on 625-21, page 97, lines 14 through 19. So the jurors heard this evidence about
the first of those, that it was a powder believed to be cocaine. What was the testimony? About the field test, or was it just that that's what they thought it was?
The way it came in, there was questioning, as I recall, and it was about the field test, and there was a question about the affidavit in the support of the warrant, and in that affidavit, there was some evidence that it had field tested for cocaine that came in from Agent Nam. So there was some confusion in the record on this point, and I think back to your question, Judge, I don't agree that even if you find one overall overarching conspiracy, and I certainly don't concede that point, but even if you find against me on that point, I think the unanimity instruction, which was requested here, should have been given. And I think this court should make a point, frankly, trial judges, a very low transaction cost to give that instruction, especially when there's any question about confusion of the jury as to which conspiracy they're going to convict him on. So I certainly don't understand why that.
I guess I'm confused as to if you concede, and I understand you're not gonna do it, but if you assume that there was only one conspiracy, I'm still not understanding what would the jury have been confused about? That the jury would have been thinking that there was two conspiracies and convicted him of the wrong of the two conspiracies, but if there's just one conspiracy, then they would have convicted him for a sub conspiracy within the one conspiracy. I'm not understanding why the unanimity instruction is still has any merit if there's only one conspiracy.
It's certainly possible at trial that the jurors might have found that Mr. Beal was involved in a fentanyl conspiracy involving California. And
that's two conspiracies. So, I mean, it does depend on the two conspiracies in the end. You can't explain it except by saying there could have been a different conspiracy.
No, even if there's one overarching conspiracy, I think that jurors could have thought in their heads that there's one conspiracy, which is the fentanyl conspiracy, because they heard the testimony from the one co-conspirator who came in who was very clear, absolutely no discussion of fentanyl whatsoever in what I'm calling the Hawaii, but more accurately could be called the California to Hawaii conspiracy. That testimony was very clear. There were no discussions about fentanyl. There was no fentanyl used at all. This was the government's witness who brought this evidence forward. And so I think jurors could have been presented with a choice here. Either A, acquit Mr. Beal, who they had very clear evidence was guilty of it, maybe arguably a fentanyl conspiracy, a California to Ohio conspiracy, or convict him of being involved in a conspiracy he really wasn't involved in at all. I mean, there was literally no mention.
So to get off this, you have an argument to make on the chain of custody question, which, as I understand it, has sort of two components. One is whether the evidence should have been introduced, and the other is how it played out at trial.
Well, I think the chain of custody question is more of an admissibility question. I'm arguing that it should not have been admitted. And there are very many reasons for this. First off, there's no question there was an 8-day break in the chain of custody. Right. This evidence was sent at some point to Quantico.
What I'm particularly interested in is that the judge was wrong about one fact, which is whether the label on the drugs was the same throughout, because in fact it wasn't.
That's right, Judge.
Was that key to his admissibility decision, such that we could disapprove the decision on the ground that he made a clear error as to that fact?
Yes, Judge. In fact, if you look at my excerpts of the record from 11 to 36, you will find the judge's ruling on this point. The judge makes much to do about the fact that he believed, erroneously we know now, that the same case number was following that white powder from when it was seized in Ohio all the way through when it was tested in California.
So he was wrong about that, but it does seem, the record does seem to support that the piece of paper that was with it, whatever you call that thing, the chain of custody form, followed that white powder. Like it left, I mean, unless you assume that the piece of paper is lying on it, which you guess you could assume about any chain of custody form, but there's no more reason to think that about this one than any other one. It shows that it left Ohio, and it shows it arrived in Honolulu 8 days later. So that, I mean, and it's weird to think that piece of paper didn't do that. And why wouldn't you think the drugs went with that piece of paper? I mean, your whole argument is that because it was shipped to Quantico, and we don't know what happened in Quantico, and then it ended up in Honolulu, that something must have happened in that time. But we have testimony that says what the ordinary thing that would happen, and why does that not suffice to bridge that? The same way that if somebody was to give testimony and say, well, we know the drugs are taken out of a locker, what ordinarily happens? Well, ordinarily, this is how I do it. And you say, and you have speculation about, they got all messed up in that process. And we'd say, well, but we have testimony about what ordinarily happens.
Actually, Judge, it's an excellent question. I'm happy to clarify this. First of all, the piece of paper that you're talking about, the evidence log, which is my excerpts of 176, which was Exhibit 44 at trial. If you look at that, you'll find that piece of paper makes clear that the drugs were completely lost. For it doesn't have a clear chain of custody. It shows they were shipped, and then there's an 8-day lapse in the chain of custody. We don't know what happened during that period of time. Now, the government tries to save this with the testimony you were talking about. This is the evidence manager of the Quantico lab. That person got on the stand. But if you review that testimony, and if you look at it, it's actually the second volume of the government's supplemental excerpts of records, 346 to 349. That testimony, in my opinion, was devastating to this argument that they solved that problem. That person, Ms. Martin, testified, she had no idea whether that package was ever received in or sent out of Quantico. No idea about whether
the package. So I understand your argument on this, which is that they can't tell you anything about this particular package. I don't see how that's any different than, you know, you see somebody FBI testifies, we put this package in a FedEx box with this number and we shipped it off. And then you said, and if your argument was, and we have no idea what happened for the 3 days, it just shows up miraculously 3 days later to where they had shipped it to, and we have no idea. It's like, okay, so you bring in the FedEx guy and say, what happens? Well, normally when something's shipped, it does this, and then it ends up in a ship to Honolulu, and it ends up in Honolulu. And that's what normally, well, can you say anything about that? That's what happened in this particular, well, no, we don't know what happened with this particular package, but that's normally what happens. Basically, we've got the same thing, except for you've got Quantico acting as like a little middleman here. It says, what we normally do, we get it from FedEx and we open up, we see it's too much drugs for us to test. Put it back together and we ship it off.
There's no testimony like that in this case, Judge. The testimony from the evidence lab at Quantico, and I certainly asked the court to just review it. They say they have no idea what happened. They can't confirm even that their own procedures were followed when it finally hit Quantico. They have no idea what happens, a complete lapse. The judge admitted it because the judge erroneously believed that number tracked all the way through. And the last point I want to make on that number, and I'm going to sit down so I don't lose my rebuttal time. But if that number, if that person had checked the actual package to see if that original number was on that package, and then they changed the number, I wouldn't be standing here arguing this. But the person who changed the number never looked at the package, and there was no testimony in the case to say that that package of drugs actually had the original number on it.
I thought, just a minute, two things. I thought he crossed out a number.
They did cross out a number, but the person who crossed out the number never looked at the package to make sure that that original number was actually ever on the package, and there is no testimony.
So what did he cross it out
on the evidence log. If you look at the evidence log, you'll find it crossed out with an initial.
And finally, on what page is the judge's ruling that includes the erroneous determination? I'm trying to find it, but I'm not finding it in the record. I mean, SCR. Six something.
I gave it in if you look at my excerpts of the record, pages 11 through 36, the judge gives the judge's analysis of why the chain of custody argument fails.
Okay. It.
And
it's,
you'll see
so
it's all based on that number, which the judge was clearly wrong, just made a mistake about. Thank you, Judge.
We took you past your time, but we'll give you two
Thank
minutes.
Thank you.
From the government.
May it please the court. Good morning. Tom Miller for the United States. Your Honor, the United States position, of course, is that there was no problem with the chain of custody. The district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting the fentanyl. The fentanyl and the packaging materials were sealed by the FBI. The chain of custody, both by the Ohio State Highway Patrol and the FBI, clearly document where the drugs were, how they were seized, what happened after they were seized.
It seems to me like the district court sort of misunderstood it, and I don't know how this stuff works either, but that somehow like you take a sticker and you put it on the bag, the kilo bag of drugs, and you write a number and the sticker is on the bag on the drugs. And that's kind of what I thought when I first started looking at this case. But then I came to conclude there's never been a number on any of the bags throughout the years long, that it was always any number would be on that form. And that form travels with the bags, but that the bags don't have, like, it's not like you stamp a number on the actual evidence itself. Is that a right understanding of?
That's my understanding, that the bags were sealed. They were not numbered. Then they were shipped. They were handled properly. They were accounted for in the chain of custody.
We don't know how they were handled. We don't know anything about how they were handled, right? What do we know? We know what's on the chain of custody for, but we don't know how they were handled, and we don't know whether they were ever weighed when they at any point until the end. Is that correct?
We believe we know how they were handled because each person that handled them testified. They were not weighed ahead of time. We know each individual. From Trooper Rachel Simmons that seized him, she turned them over to her supervisor, Sergeant Chris Coverstone. He handled them properly, locked them up early morning hours of December 11th, because the seizure happened at about 11:30, I believe, on December 10th. He put it in the Piqua barracks, Ohio State Police Highway Patrol barracks evidence locker, or drug locker. Picked them up early the next morning, I think about 10 o'clock, and then directed Sergeant Michael Mahaffey to take them to the FBI. They were all signed off on that chain of custody, which was the Ohio State Police chain of custody, which is Exhibit 43. They went to the FBI and they were received at the lunchtime by Teresa Budham. She was a clerk. It was at the lunch hour. It was of course, closed FBI building. The Ohio State Highway Patrolman Mahaffey came there. She saw him on the camera. She let him in the door, which is controlled. She took the drugs that were sealed and then held on to them, the evidence, not just the drugs, but the packaging material, also the backpack, which was, I think, Exhibit 40, the black backpack, which held the drugs. And the shopping bag, and then the Walmart white plastic bag, and then the two sealed drug packets that were inside. She took them, held them at her desk for an hour, and then gave them to Leah Brock, who was the evidence custodian at the Dayton FBI resident agency. They were taken out and sealed again, according to the FBI procedures, by Agent Dennis.
But what does that mean, taken out, by the way?
Taken out of the drug vault. They were signed out of the drug vault where they were held secure.
And were they, I couldn't quite tell whether they, did they remain in the black backpack?
No, they were the drugs were separated from the black backpack. The black backpack was held separately, and the drugs were then put on the FBI chain of custody.
In these bags that they were in, with the paper bag, and that was also gone.
The brown paper bag and the white the white plastic bag from Walmart and the drugs were sealed together by Agent Ng. Then they were, and the backpack was kept separately. The drugs were sealed and then put back into the vault at the Dayton resident agency, FBI resident agency, by Brock. Then Brock was directed to send them to the Quantico laboratory, and she sent per Agent Ng's direction. And on the 23rd of December, she sent them out FedEx to the FBI laboratory. And I agree, that's where the documentation is not, it's not documented. They were sent out. They were sent out by FedEx. And then 8 days later, on the 31st of December, New Year's Eve, they were received at the Quantico laboratory. They were received by the FBI Honolulu office in Kapolei by Pauline Cummings, who was the drug evidence custodian there. They were held there, then they were shipped to the DEA lab. They were received at the DEA lab by Monica Price. There was a period of time, it was about 4 years, that they were held in the evidence locker at Honolulu, Your Honor. They were shipped out by Pauline Cummings. They were then they sat at the DEA vault, vault at the laboratory in Vista, California for about a year because that's...
All right, I think we know all that, but I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
You were impressive in your detail, but the question that I asked before, which is it in the record that this was originally field tested to be cocaine?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch all
the... Is it in the record that this was originally field tested to be cocaine?
In the trial record?
Or in the trial record or in the record that was before the district judge when he determined the motion to suppress.
The motion to suppress, that came out in the motion to suppress. At the trial, counsel for Mr. Beal, different counsel, had a motion in limine to keep out the field test, a result that was cocaine. So that did not come out at trial. There was a slip by Agent Rudow, retired Agent Joel Rudow, that he said that there was a cocaine or field test or something like that. He was admonished and they moved to strike.
But it was in the record at the time of the motion to suppress. Therefore it was before the district judge when he made his decision. Or was it also at that time, I still haven't been able to find it, that the district court stated erroneously that there was a single label on the custody or number? Was that also in the motion to suppress?
No, Your Honor, that was in the post-trial Rule 29 motion for a new trial.
I see. So where is the judge's ruling on the motion to suppress in the record? That's what I can't find.
Where is the judge's ruling?
Yes.
That was, the motion to suppress was in April, I want to say 29th of 2021. Right.
Well, it's somewhere. I haven't been able to find it. It must be somewhere. Okay. So at that point, he didn't make this mistake, is your understanding?
There was no mistake made I say there was a mistake made because I can't find it in the record. So I believe that's erroneous, the statement about the labeling on that. But the record is clear how those drugs were handled. They were sealed. They were received intact at the DEA laboratory in Vista. They were identified by the individuals that seized them at the trial, both by the packaging. They acknowledged there was repackaging. Mahaffey said it seemed to be the
kind of back to my original question. The judge made a mistake, and he seemed to be operating under the idea that these drugs had a label on them, they had a number on them, and obviously they didn't. And if even if they had, it wouldn't have been that number. That number wasn't invented until years later.
Until later.
So, but what I'm trying to figure out is, so when I first saw that, I was like, oh, that seems like a pretty significant mistake. But then I came to the conclusion that, well, it didn't have a label on them, but they did have this piece of paper, the chain of custody form. And I don't know how that chain of custody form, which was signed in Ohio, would have gotten to Honolulu, you know, during this 8-day period. The actual form, this form, which is signed, has a whole bunch of signatures of people signing it in Ohio, and an exact same piece of paper is being signed by people in Honolulu. I don't know how it would have gotten there unless it was essentially traveling with these drugs, like as almost like a label. So from my perspective, the judge was wrong that there was a sticker or something on each of the packages of drugs that had this number on it. But he was not wrong in the sense that there was obviously this chain of custody form traveled with those drugs from Ohio. They were mailed to or FedExed to Quantico. And then 8 days later, this chain of custody form showed up in Honolulu with two bags of white powder. And so...
And the clothing and the packaging.
So in some sense, like the judge was wrong about there being a label on it, but in some sense, this is the label. Like this chain of custody form seems to be the... Why, am I right about that?
The United States believes the court is correct that the chain of custody form, the FBI chain of custody form, accompanies the drugs because they were in the FBI custody at that time.
But do they normally put... I mean, I get the impression... I don't even know how this normally works, but now I get the impression from this one case that you wouldn't normally put a sticker on the drug packages. This is, in a sense, the sticker, the piece of paper, this chain of custody form. It travels around kind of like the sticker, like what this judge thought was the sticker on these items.
Is the FBI chain of custody form does accompany the drugs when they left from the Dayton resident agency through Quantico.
So his logic, as I read the district court judge's logic, his logic is, listen, yeah, we don't know exactly what happened specifically because we don't have any testimony about anybody remembering. We have this testimony of what normally happens, and we know that there's evidence that it got there, that it left, and he thinks it's a sticker, but you could replace that with it left with a certain chain of custody form, and 8 days later it arrived at the same with the chain of custody. And see, so it seems to me the judge's law and judge really relied on that logic. And it seems to me that logic is still intact, even though we got this the number and the idea that there was a sticker on the drugs incorrect.
The change in the case number, as I admit, that's erroneous.
Well, he wouldn't even be right. So, he wouldn't even be right, even if he had the other number, the one that's crossed out, which is probably the number. He wouldn't be right about it because there wouldn't be a number on the drugs on the clear plastic bags. There wouldn't be a number, right, when they left Ohio.
The drugs, when they left Ohio in the FBI custody, included that FBI chain of custody.
All right.
There was a separate Ohio State Highway Patrol chain of custody, which was last signed by the, and it ended when it was turned over to the FBI.
There wouldn't be a sticker. My point is there wouldn't be some sticker on, you know, if I had a 1 kilo bag of white powder here, it wouldn't have no sticker. It would just have a chain of custody form with it.
It would be sealed, and it normally, my understanding is it's marked by the agent. You're with initials on it, like it's marked.
What is the chain of custody form or the drug?
The drugs, Your Honor, in the plastic bag.
They like write on it with a
Sharpie.
Sharpie or something?
And
yes.
Why do they write on it?
They initial it. They may put, they, my understanding
but they
is
they don't put one of these numbers on it.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I can't
right,
answer.
Can I ask a more global question? Okay, I'm looking at the judge's ruling on the motion to dismiss, order denying motion to suppress, but there's nothing in there about this chain of custody problem. Did he ever rule in advance on admissibility
Not at the motion to suppress, Your Honor.
When did he rule on
that? That was not, he ruled on admissibility at the trial, after the last witness testified. We tried to offer the exhibit and the chain of custody through the various witnesses, and defense counsel, Mr. Isaacson, kept objecting.
So where is that in the record? I'm still trying to see where the district judge actually ruled, and I'm trying to find out to which he relied on this question of the number. He knew from the motion to suppress about the that there had been a field test for cocaine, but it wasn't at the trial. It was only alluded to at the trial. Is that accurate?
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. Correct.
And then where exactly do I find the ruling? These kinds of things are supposed to be in the first volume of the excerpts of record, but as far as I can tell, they're not. So where are they?
The ruling occurred after Monica Price, the drug
enforcer. Okay, but where? Just give me a page number where I can find it.
I can if you give me a moment, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe.
SER 373 and 374.
373 is
them. Yeah, because there's not much reasoning there. That's just a overruling.
It's our supplemental excerpt of record, Your Honor.
All right, I'll find it. It's not worth time. Go ahead.
It was on June 24th, Your Honor, in our supplemental excerpts of record. I can find it, but I would like to
all right,
cover
go ahead. Go ahead.
I would like to cover the argument as to the separate, the multiple conspiracies.
Okay, briefly, please. I said briefly, you're over your time, but
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The instruction that was given on conspiracy was a fentanyl conspiracy. And the verdict form talked about a fentanyl verdict form as the conspiracy. The defendant, Mr. Beal, did not object to that verdict form. He only objected to the instruction as to the knowledge. The rest of the fentanyl conspiracy instruction, he only objected to the knowledge that the government, that the defendant didn't have to know the specific drug, but knew that it was some type of controlled substance. He of course argued that before the judge on the Rule 29 and in front of the jury. He argued that it was a fentanyl conspiracy, that there may have been a methamphetamine conspiracy in Hawaii, but he wasn't part of that. That was separate from him. He also severed this case. He moved to sever, and it was clearly the United States. He wanted nothing to do with the co-defendants that were charged in Hawaii with more substantive offenses and to stay away from that. So the argument that a unanimity instruction is needed and that a multiple conspiracy instruction or the multiple conspiracy is there is sort of watered down, because he did get to argue that it was his client was charged in a fentanyl conspiracy and that he wasn't involved in Hawaii, and Hawaii was all these
other. But if he wasn't involved in Hawaii, why was he being tried in Hawaii?
The defendant argued, of course, he wasn't in Hawaii because he was never in Hawaii. He didn't know those people in Hawaii. The people in Hawaii, Mr. Olivetti didn't know him. Mr. Olivetti didn't know fentanyl. But it's clear that to his benefit that he made that argument. And it was clear to the United States that his whole tenor of his strategic decision was made to keep himself away from the Hawaii part of the conspiracy.
Okay.
And a unanimity.
We get the anonymity question.
I won't.
What I want to know is whether there's, because that only makes any sense if there were in fact a basis for thinking there were two conspiracies. I don't understand the argument to the contrary. But the question is what you're saying is it doesn't matter if there was a Hawaii, if he was part of the Hawaii conspiracy?
No,
it does matter, right?
We certainly believe it was one conspiracy, Your Honor.
Right.
That the group that they looked at in California, where the drugs came from, the fentanyl came from, was going east rather than going west.
But is it true that the member of the conspiracy who testified said he didn't know anything about fentanyl?
That was Mr. Olivetti. Takivalu Takivalu Obadi testified that he did not know fentanyl and he did not know the defendant and he did not discuss fentanyl with Mr. Fanua.
Did Mr. Fanua say that he didn't testify, right?
Mr. Fanua is set for trial in February.
Right, so he didn't testify.
No.
So did anybody from the Hawaii conspiracy say that there was anything to do with fentanyl in the Hawaii conspiracy?
The only cooperator we had at that point was Mr. Olivetti. Right. And
so if Hawaii, the only evidence was that the Hawaii conspiracy had nothing to do with fentanyl, then how was he convicted of the Hawaii conspiracy?
Well, Agent Rudolph explained that he had identified through the wiretap a group in Oakland that was transporting drugs into Hawaii that was being distributed by Hawaii distributors. And of course, that's Mr. Olivao, Mr. Olivetti, and the person that was doing that, the head of that was Mr. Fanua. It was California drugs coming to Hawaii, and the fentanyl was California drugs that went east. But it was the same overlap in the time frame.
But the only evidence, direct evidence from anybody involved was that the Hawaii conspiracy didn't have anything to do with fentanyl. So what was the connection?
The connection was who was sending it, Mr. Fanua. He was using his people to move the fentanyl east. He had just a month previously in September, had sent methamphetamine to Mr. Olivetti, which was then sold on September 24th at Ma'alaya Wharf on Maui to an undercover police officer.
That's methamphetamine, but I'm asking about this is now turned into a fentanyl conspiracy, right? That's what you said. And so what, I'm having trouble seeing what connected the whole Hawaii conspiracy to the fentanyl.
We argued that it was a methamphetamine, cocaine, and fentanyl conspiracy.
All right, but he himself did not handle any methamphetamine, and despite the field test, cocaine, as far as we now know.
Mr. Beal, do not have him involved with methamphetamine, Your Honor.
Or cocaine.
Well, no, we don't. We have, of course, we have a prior drug conviction, but that didn't come out. That only came out to show knowledge. He has a prior drug conviction for cocaine in the district, U.S. District Court in the District of New Mexico in 2004. And that evidence came out only to show knowledge when he said, when he was interviewed in Phoenix in September of 2019 by Agent Rudolph, that he had no idea.
The evidence is clearly sufficient to show that he was involved. Leaving the chain of custody out for the moment, that he was involved in the transportation, at least, of fentanyl for 10 minutes in Dayton, Ohio, 5 years before he was charged, right? So he was involved in some kind of a drug transaction involving fentanyl in Ohio.
With Mr. Fanua.
With Mr. Fanua, okay. With Mr. Fanua, because he spoke to Mr. Fanua?
No, we don't have any evidence he spoke to Mr. Fanua. We don't have evidence that he was intercepted on the wiretap. It was the wiretap.
It was the person who he got it from who was dealing with
Fanua. The person who he got it from was intercepted on the wiretap and was in Hawaii.
So we don't even know that he simply didn't, that this guy in Dayton called him up and said, would you carry some, even assuming that he knew it was drugs, carry some drugs for me. Or that we don't have any evidence that he knew about Fanua.
We don't know that, of course. The law is pretty clear. You don't have to know every member of the conspiracy to become a member or to be liable for the conspiracy.
But he knew one person and it turned out to be fentanyl, which he either did or didn't know. We don't know that. Which the one person from the conspiracy who testified said was not involved in the conspiracy. So what is the sufficient evidence?
Well,
there's sufficient evidence that he was transporting some drugs for somebody.
Right.
And he may have been part of a, if you call that a conspiracy with the person that he got the drugs from to transport drugs in Ohio. But beyond that, what do we have?
We have him involved with Mr. Fanua.
Well, we don't have him involved. We have the person that he got the drugs from.
Not directly, okay. But we have him involved with Mr. Fanua through Mr. Chells and through the intermediary that where the drugs were going out to Ohio. Mr. Fanua, of course, sent drugs also to Hawaii, and that's clear from that part of the testimony of Mr. Olivetti, Mr. Agent Nam, Agent Rudow, explaining what they had. As far as direct one-on-one, you're correct, Your Honor. I don't have that with him in methamphetamine in Hawaii. I've gone way over. My apologies.
I'll be answering questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, and minutes.
Thank you, Judge. Members of the panel, this is almost impossible to do in 15 minutes aside. There's a lot of evidence. It's nobody's fault. It's just the nature of our situation. The issues are well briefed, and I really urge the panel to look at it. Judge, you hit the nail on the head. It's even worse than was discussed here. Mr. Beal is talking to somebody who's identified at trial as Mr. X. Mr. X is in charge, connected. We know nothing about Mr. X. Mr. X is speaking to a guy named Chels. Chels isn't charged in Hawaii, has nothing to do with Hawaii whatsoever. Chels is
going to... Let me give you a really quick example. You got Mr. Let's call him Mr. Big, all right? Mr. Big is runs this organization, right? But he likes to keep his people separate because he doesn't want... So Mr. Big works with... He has two divisions. He has a division that works on the east side of town. He has a division that works on the west side of town, right? But the east side people don't talk to the west side people, et cetera. But they all work through Mr. Big and, like, say, two other people that are at the top. All right. Is that one conspiracy or two conspiracies?
It depends, Judge, if there's a
rift. But it could be one conspiracy. You would agree the situation like that could be one conspiracy.
If there's a rim that binds the spokes together, then you got one. In this case, there's not even great dust.
If it's a rim, I would think that if they're all working through Mr. Big in the middle, then it's one conspiracy.
That's not this case, Judge.
In other words, there's been a lot of emphasis on the fact that we know a lot about Hawaii, but there's also the fact that the people in the middle are involved in both. And so then we keep calling this a Hawaii conspiracy, but that's why I said earlier on, it's a California conspiracy. And we definitely know people from California were involved in this, right?
But they're not the same people, Judge. Fonua is sending drugs to Hawaii from California. Fonua's dealing with Chels. Chels isn't even involved. Chels isn't charged. Chels is, if you don't even know who Chels is. Chels is talking to Mr. X. Mr. X is talking to Beal.
That's the way conspiracies
but
work.
There's no rim. There has to be a rim. And in the Kenny case.
What do you mean? What does it mean there has to be a rim?
Well, this is what the Supreme Court said in the, I'm going to butcher the name, the Kotiakis case. Okay. Yes. And also in Kenny, the Ninth Circuit talked about this in Kenny. There's got to be something that connects the independent spokes together. And in this case,
I see. So what you're saying is the fact that there's one guy in the middle isn't good enough.
It's not good enough. That's exactly what Kotiakis was about. Judge, to answer your question, what you're looking for is in the excerpts of the record, in my excerpts, from page 11 to page 36. That details exactly what the judge's reasoning was.
But on that motion to suppress, there was nothing about the...
It wasn't a motion to suppress, Judge. It was my Rule 29 motion.
It was a discussion on the Rule 29.
The judge relied heavily on the erroneous number.
Yes.
I got the chain of custody right here. If you look at it, you'll see from 1223 to 1231, nobody knows what happened. And if you just simply review the testimony that the government relies on, Aaron Martin, which is the second volume of the supplemental excerpts, 346 to 349, you'll see she has absolutely no information whatsoever, even if it came to Quantico who handled it, or even if their procedures that they discussed hypothetically were even followed in this case. And the last thing I wanted to say very quickly was, I don't feel
like... Can I ask one question about that? Do we have the FedEx... label that shows it was sent to Quantico?
There was testimony in the record that it came from Quantico. It didn't say how she knew about that. I assume it was because of the FedEx. We don't know who sent the FedEx, what happened, or any of that.
But to get, was there a label going to Quantico?
I'm not aware if there was. I didn't see anything in the record, but I can't say that there wasn't. And also,
the chain of custody form has the FedEx tracking number of the person who sent it to Quantico, right?
It does, but there was nothing in the record, nor was there anything in the record about this evidence log traveling with the drugs. We're talking about that now, but that never came in. It's not in the judge's order. The last thing I wanted to say...
So is your position then? You think that they just kind of like mailed this chain of custody form, like, to Honolulu and mailed the drugs to, I mean, it's just like pure speculation on your part. That it to me, it seems just speculative or more speculative than the idea that, yeah, you shipped it via FedEx. Let's say they just shipped it straight to Honolulu, but we don't know what happened in the middle of that FedEx. If somebody, you know, FedEx pilot could have, you know, stepped out of the cockpit, walked back and opened up the package and swapped out the, you know, the drugs or something like that. Well, I mean, here it's just pure speculation.
We know it was sent to Quantico. Eight days go
by. Yeah, you agree with that. You agree that the drugs were sent to Quantico, but it sounds to me like you're now saying, yeah, but I don't know that the evidence chain was, I don't know that this chain of custody thing was sent to Quantico. Well, how else would we have this chain of custody thing today?
Judge, it could have been a Dropbox for all I know. I don't know where the evidence log, how
but,
that
but the problem is, this is the problem I have with your whole argument. It's extremely speculative. You could make that argument about anything in here. You could say, well, they accepted custody on 12-14, well, and then several days later, it has another signature, but we don't know what happened. We don't know if this chain of custody form was put with those drugs when they were put into the evidentiary locker, or whether somebody just, like, you know, left the chain of custody form sitting around the lab. The problem is you're just totally speculating that procedures weren't followed appropriately. And all of this, the whole chain of custody form depends upon the fact, the presumption that normal procedures are followed. And we do have testimony about what the procedures are when Quantico receives a quantity of drugs like that. And you keep saying we don't have it, but we do have it. We don't have it specifically about these, but we have what normally happens, correct? Do you agree with that?
We have testimony, but the testimony doesn't say what you're representing it says. The testimony is very clear that Aaron Martin doesn't have any idea whether even their procedures were followed in Quantico. She can't say they received it. She doesn't know who handled it.
But again, that's the same thing as saying, if I say, would you know, do you have specific knowledge the procedures were followed for the 2 years that the drugs actually sat in the, and that somebody didn't go in there and accidentally swap out the drugs or something like that? You say, well, I don't have direct knowledge of that, but normally that wouldn't happen because our normal procedures are A, B, and C. And that's the exact same type of testimony we have here.
Judge, that's why we have a chain of custody form, so we don't have to guess.
No, that's not true, though, because the chain of custody form actually has built into it. So when a chain of custody form says something gets locked into a locker for 2 years, it doesn't say in there that it's under video surveillance being watched the whole time. That's built into the chain of custody form is the idea that they are following normal procedures. Yes. That is, and what you're trying to do is, because there's an 8-day gap between when something was shipped to Quantico and when it arrived in Honolulu, and that we have testimony about what those normal procedures are, you're trying to say, we don't have any idea what happened. But you could make the same argument for the years that this thing sat in an evidence locker somewhere.
I wouldn't make that argument because,
well, of course you wouldn't. But my point is that their argument is no stronger for those 8 days.
It is stronger, Judge, because the chain of custody, while it sat in California for all those years when it wasn't tested, or in Honolulu for those years when it wasn't tested, it shows where it is. We know where.
Yeah, but
it is.
How do we know that somebody didn't go in there and when they were trying to grab some other drugs, accidentally grabbed these, and that the form had kind of slipped over and fallen on those other drugs? How do we know that?
Now I'm into the cases where we're speculating about.
And you're not. And you're just as much speculating, because what we do know here is we have an chain of custody form that it was mailed off to Quantico. We have testimony from somebody that this is what would happen if I was to receive a quantity of drugs this size. I would not test them. I would just mail them off to whoever controlled them, which would be the Honolulu office, based on the number that was crossed out. That would be the normal process. And you're just saying, well, no, but something else must have happened.
Judge, my client is serving 15 years in prison. We should have procedures that somebody in Quantico says, I received it. I put it in the evidence locker. It sat there for 8 days.
We might say that, but you could make the exact same argument about the fact, say, you know, the drugs literally sat in a thing for 2 years and there's nothing on here about what happened during that time. We should have procedures where they're kept under cameras. Sure. At the end of the day, the whole system is built on that. It tells you what happens on this form when they get switched out, but there are periods of time when you just have to assume that the presumption of regularity is what we often call it, that there's a presumption of regularity. And what I'm trying to figure out is, for that 8 days, why wouldn't we just apply the same presumption of regularity? If we didn't have any testimony about what happens normally when drugs get shipped to Quantico, I think you'd have a lot stronger case. But we do have testimony about what happens in the normal case. You would agree with that, right?
We have testimony. And if it's reviewed, Judge, you'll see she says, I don't know it was ever received. I don't know our procedures were followed. I can't say anything.
Exactly. But she does tell you what normally would happen. if they were to receive drugs like that, and it fits with the 8 days that are on this custody form.
Judge, right? The government has the burden to prove the chain of custody.
And keep in mind, like your position would require that somehow weird things happened to the drugs while they were in Quantico. In other words, this procedure that she testified about was not followed, but somehow the chain of custody form made its way through, but the drugs were switched out or something.
We have no evidence that the chain of custody followed those drugs. None. There's nothing in the record about that.
You know what? But that would be just as true. That's just as true when we say we put the drugs into the locker, right? And you say we put the drugs in the locker for 2 years. We have no evidence that Joe, FBI officer Joe, didn't just take the chain of custody form and throw it in the bottom drawer of his desk. And then 2 years later, be like, what is this? And they walk back and are like, well, here's some drugs without a chain of custody form. Let's put it on. But that's all pure speculation.
That's where your presumption of regularity comes in, Judge. If it's sitting in if the chain of custody shows it's sitting in the evidence locker for 4 years, and I'm sitting here arguing, hey, I don't know what happened during those 4 years,
But if you have somebody that testified and said, you know what, we sent the drugs to Quantico, and then we have 8 days later, say the drugs came from Quantico, and you have testimony about what the regular FBI procedures are that would have made that happen, and then you're just purely speculating that something else happened.
Judge, what I'm not speculating about is the chain of custody shows an 8-day break in it. Nobody knows what happens. This is a criminal case. This court ought to hold the government to a higher standard. My guy's serving 15 years, and we have no idea where this evidence went in. It tested as A, and then later on after the break, it tested as B. And so I think that's not conclusive evidence of tampering, but it's much more than we have in the speculation.
Do you think that the government made a mistake? I mean, is your theory that the government made a mistake, or is your theory that the government like nefariously, intentionally swapped these drugs out?
I have no evidence of any bad faith here, Judge. I'm not making that case, but I don't have to show that. All I need to show is negligence. I got the substance testing as cocaine at the scene. It wasn't weighed. The packages were different. The people who testified at trial said...
What do you mean the packages were different?
The people who testified at trial said it was packaged differently. Officer Simmons, who pulled him over...
But there was testimony that it was repackaged between the time when it was packaged in Ohio. Between the time it was packaged in Ohio and it was sent off, and then when they tested it, the lab said that they repackaged it. They said he split it into two different samples for each one. So, I mean,
Judge, if the chain of custody is intact, I'm not here because I can't quarrel about they opened it and put it in a different bag. But in the context,
I guess ultimately I'm quibbling with the idea that this chain of custody form is not intact. You have times in the chain of custody, in every chain of custody form, where drugs are not, I mean, they're not like constantly being handed from one person to another with people. There are times when it is resting or when it's in, and that includes in the ordinary course, you'd have to agree that would include shipping. Like when they hand it to the FedEx guy and he takes it off and it takes several days to get from point A to point B, you don't know what happened to those drugs during that time, but you have a presumption of regularity. And here, what you're saying is, yes, I'm okay with that, but I'm not okay with Quantico being in the middle, even though there's testimony of what Quantico does. It sounds very much like what a FedEx person would say if you put them on the stand and say, well, what happens when you ship this through Memphis? And they say, well, what happens is it comes off the plane, it goes on a little conveyor belt, and it goes back on. And I just don't see where there's actually a gap here.
Judge, I guess the question is, should Quantico be held to a standard in a criminal case where they're dealing with 2 kilos of white powder of some type?
No, but the question is really actually, but that's not actually the question. The question is whether or not the jury could have found on this evidence, right? That's the question, is whether the jury could have found on this evidence that whether a juror, right? Because this is a substantial evidence challenge. So whether a juror could have found on this evidence that the government met its burden by holding them to the standard that they're required to hold. That's the best thing you have going for you. And I just don't see how a juror could say that a juror could not hold that when a juror could easily say, yeah, I mean, probably did what the FBI says normally happens, the same way that happens when FedEx calls something.
Judge, I'm just asking to review the testimony of Aaron Martin.
I mean, I have the testimony right here in front of me. And
the cross-examination, which she certainly admits, I have no idea,
she's saying she has no idea what happened to this specific package. The same way if you were to cross-examine a FedEx person and say, do you know what happened, the package number, blah, 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 they'd be like, we do billions every day. I have no idea. But they could tell you what happens, generally speaking, to a package that gets shipped from point A to point B. And that's what we've got here. So you keep saying, yeah, but she says, I have no idea. But she's not saying she has no idea what normally happens.
FedEx can tell you where the package is at all times, Judge. And they just sent it from FedEx from Ohio to Honolulu. We have no problem here. The judge made some mistakes here in terms of trying to save it because of that number. And my point here was, if the evidence tech had gone and checked the package and say, hey, look, it's the 2014.
I know your point. The question is just whether or not, I know you're pointing to irregularities, and the question is whether or not your those irregularities are enough to make it so that the government doesn't have substantial evidence.
I don't know what bigger irregularities I could bring to your attention than the chain of custody is absolutely broken for 8 days and nobody has any idea where it is. The last thing, I know my time is coming.
I think we understand your argument. Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
And we thank both counsel for their arguments in this case. Thank you. Okay, submitted.